and welcome to The Wire, where you can get independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
And people are like, oh, well,
Welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station right around Australia. I'm Sophie Ellis in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire...
January 5th, the day before, in a podcast, he said, it's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. So many people said, man, if I was in a revolution, I would be in Washington. Well, this is your time in history.
Former advisor to President Trump, Steve Bannon, has been found in contempt of Congress by a US committee over his failure to comply with their investigation into the January 6th Capitol Hill riots. He could face up to 12 months jail time. Also on the program tonight...
That's not viable. That's not a roadmap out of this situation. A roadmap out gets us back to 100%.
The Victorian state government has been criticised as failing to consider the arts sector in its roadmap out of COVID-19 lockdown. We speak to those in the industry about what recovery might look like for the Melbourne arts scene. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire. But first... The inquiry into the Juukan Gorge disaster has come to an end, finding that current state and federal legislation neglects to protect cultural and heritage sites. Amongst a long history of land destruction, the inquiry has proven to be a significant turning point and a time to implement new legislation. Chair of the National Native Title Council, Cato Muir, has been pleased to see the action and change to those outdated acts, but feels there is still much more to be done. He spoke to The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg about what the inquiry means for future protection of heritage land.
The report's been released the other day. It's a damning indictment on both industry and the West Australian government, showing that such complicity and a conspiracy, really, between government and industry to continue to destroy Aboriginal sites. And what we're really concerned about is that the report is actually implemented and actioned. That's the biggest concern, because Western Australian government is saying, well, they're doing the amendments to their Aboriginal Heritage Act, which fall way short of anything that, you know, stands test. And, of course, the federal government is sounding commitments, but, you know, we're heading into an election and we'd really want to ensure that there is actual... positive change that comes out of the release of this report.
And so is any of what the inquiry outlines new demands, or is this just what traditional owners have been asking for years?
What traditional owners have been asking for years? I mean, we want effective protection of our culture and our heritage. Every time a site is destroyed, it exacerbates the trauma that we suffer as a result of colonisation and dispossession. And so it reflects, you know, back on cultural loss and loss of our heritage. Every site destroyed means the remaining places, their importance is elevated. So, you know, it's really a... damning indictment on the conspiracy between government and industry. Fortunately, some of the work that we've been doing with National Native Title Council, the First Nations Heritage Protection Alliance, is with investors and responsible investment. And in that way, we've been able to bring the money players into the conversation, who then starts running a careful eye over the impact of their investment on communities. So hopefully, you know, if there's no action by government, at least there is this positive response from the investment community, expectations of how government and industry should interact with First Nations peoples.
And so what kind of legislation would be implemented if this inquiry is fully taken on board?
Well, at the federal level, we need a federal legislation that's an oversight, also a last resort. We need certain amendments. So one of the big, massive issues highlighted by this report is the complete power imbalance between a multinational corporation like Rio Tinto negotiating with an Aboriginal community, they control a lot of the purse strings on, you know, compensation monies, which is outrageous. You know, if there's money that's compensation paid, it should be unencumbered. But what you find is a lot of the companies actually encumber the compensation monies and therefore affect control over how native title groups are able to engage.
And how involved will Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people be in constructing the legislation that follows from this inquiry?
Well, federal level, they're talking to First Nations Heritage Protection Alliance, you know, committing to a process of consultation and engagement. At the West Australian level, the state government has run away with the agenda. They're basically coming around. Their idea of consultation is to come and tell us what they've done. And that's not consultation. That's not free, prior, and informed consent. And that's not effective co-design engagement.
And so does this inquiry and the promise of potential legislation help heal any of the hurt traditional owners have been experiencing?
That's something that's been left out of this, is the process of healing, because effectively when we're affected by trauma, and government needs to remember, is that what they're effectively doing is they're exacerbating the process of colonisation, taking away our land and giving it to third parties. What this demonstrates is that they do it without remorse or without consequence.
What would that process look like ideally for you?
Building in, so taking notice of our cultural authority leaders, giving them a voice, giving them some prominence so that they're able to say no when an important place is subject to destruction.
Cato Muir, Chair of the Native Title Council, speaking there with The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg. In January this year, US Congress experienced the greatest breach of its hallowed grounds since the 1800s. A US House committee has since been appointed to investigate how these historic riots came to occur. However, the committee's efforts have been met with significant dispute from the former president and his supporters. Today, that committee unanimously voted to find Steve Bannon, former advisor to President Trump, in contempt of Congress for his failure to comply with a subpoena. I spoke with senior fellow at the United States Study Center, Bruce Walpe, to discuss these latest developments.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. In opinion of the chairs, the ayes have it.
What significance does the committee finding Mr. Bannon in contempt play in their investigation into the January 6 riots?
There are two things that are in play. First, the investigation itself, and that it be successful and that fulfill its mission of finding out what happened on January 6th, who was responsible, what were the communications, how much was the president involved, what direction went between the mob and the White House, if any, and to so that we have an account of what was the most serious attack on the Capitol since the British in the early 1800s, and the most hostile act of insurrection against the United States since the Civil War. So the House of Representatives wants to find out what happened in this important event. The second thing that's important is they want to be able to fulfill that responsibility by enforcing the compulsion of testimony on such a serious matter. And they believe that Steve Bannon has indispensable information, invaluable information to convey about what happened. And he's talked to the media, but he's not talking to Congress. And that is why he's being held in contempt.
Yeah, for listeners who may not be aware of Steve Bannon's role, what was his role in the Trump presidency? And why does the committee see him as such a key witness for their investigation?
He was an advisor to Trump, and so he was prominent in right-wing circles, came to Trump's attention, worked with him on the campaign, was appointed counselor to the president when Trump took office. That lasted about 8 months, and Bannon was thrown out of the White House. But as Trump has a habit of doing, he keeps bringing back people he fires. And so he and Bannon were close in the last year, during the campaign, the last year of the Trump presidency. What the committee has cited as far as why they want Bannon, what he knows, is in the days before January 6th, this is what they say in their committee report, January 5th, the day before, in a podcast, he said, it's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different. All I can say is strap in. You made this happen. Tomorrow's game day. All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. So many people said, man, if I was in a revolution, I would be in Washington. Well, this is your time in history. Well, why did he say that? That's what the committee wants to know. What did he know? That's really invaluable information to get to the bottom of what happened and why.
The committee's vote to find Steve Bannon in contempt was unanimous. What happens now?
The House of Representatives will take up the committee's resolution in the next day or so. the House will pass it. And it will be referred to the Department of Justice to enforce the subpoena. And it's a criminal contempt proceeding. So the Justice Department, I expect, will move very promptly to go to a federal court, and get further orders for Bannon to comply.
Now, former President Trump is also suing Congress and the National Archives in order to block the committee from accessing documents detailing his actions and communications surrounding the riot. His team are calling executive privilege in order to block these documents. Could you give us a rundown of what executive privilege is and how it applies to the former president?
A president does have something that's called executive privilege, which is recognized, which is a shielding of his direct direct communications with officials and staff in order to protect the functioning of the presidency, let it operate without just, 24/7 open scrutiny. Trump has asserted that executive privilege applies to this information about Steve Bannon, and he'll assert it with others. He says anyone who cooperates with the committee is covered by executive privilege. Two problems here. Trump is not the president. He cannot assert executive privilege. Joe Biden asserts executive privilege. Joe Biden has said he doesn't recognize any privilege here. Second, executive privilege can't be used to shield criminal activity, and that's been tested in courts. We are, though, in novel ground. There hasn't been an assertion by a former president of executive privilege before, but almost all reputable legal experts say no, only the existing president has it. So Trump will try and test it in court. That's where it might get gummed up and take some time to resolve legally. The last time executive privilege was tested was under the presidency of Richard Nixon. There were tapes in the White House of his discussions with his associates and officials about what happened at Watergate. And Nixon did not want those tapes released, and he claimed executive privilege. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, no, he has to turn them over. So this is the greatest test of executive privilege since Nixon, and he was threatened with impeachment. Ultimately, he resigned before that process, but it showed the power of Congress to compel information about how the president is operating.
Bruce Wolpe, Senior Fellow at the United States Study Center, speaking with me there. Medical professionals and community leaders are concerned about how regional health systems will deal with an expected increase in COVID-19 patient admissions when New South Wales regional travel resumes next month. A state parliamentary inquiry into health outcomes and access to services in rural, regional and remote New South Wales last September showed significant flaws in the current system. Health experts are worried COVID-19 cases will be an additional burden to the limited hospital beds and ICU wards, as well as patient transport systems to and from regional hospitals. Talia Kreft asked David Lazell, state member for the Upper Hunter, how hospitals in his electorate will cope with the added pressure once regional travel resumes.
That's right. When we delayed the regional travel by Sydneysiders back to the 1st of November, and that was a very deliberate strategy to allow regional New South Wales just to catch up with their vaccination rates so that they would have the same protection in our smaller communities as they have throughout the metro areas in Sydney. And we believe that based on that scientific approach of looking at the vaccination rates and forecasting the impact of people travelling through the regions, potentially infected, yes, but with our vaccination rates, our people are protected. And that's what the delay to the regional travel is all about. It's about providing that level of protection to people in our local communities. So based on that, we may see a spike in cases occurring throughout the state. But the reality is that at the moment, there's a lot of businesses out there that are hurting. There's a lot of places that are hurting because of travel restrictions. And we know we have to start getting back to normal. So we have to take these steps forward into the unknown and somewhat to make sure that we get our lives heading back to normal. And it's a time now to actually take those steps. And Sydney starts travelling out into the regions, then we will have that level of vaccination protection that we need.
How are double vaccinated rates in the Upper Hunter now, with Muswellbrook before the walk-in clinic had one of the lowest rates in the state at under 40%? How are the rates of vaccinations now?
Well, look, they're very good at the moment in terms of the direction that they're heading in. Our first dose vaccination rates is now over 90%, and very proud of everyone coming out and getting vaccinated. So we know that within 3 weeks, everyone else, those second doses will will have kicked in as well, and everyone will come and get their second doses. So last week, in the last 7 days, we have seen our second dose rate go up by 12%. And that's now up nearly just under 70%. So if we have another week of that and then one more week on top of that, well, look, we're talking about very high, probably in the 80s percentile range. And that's where we need to be to provide that protection. So I'm pretty proud of the people of Muswellbrook, of Singleton, and they've come out. They were a long way behind, but it's really accelerating now. And this additional protection that the regional travel restrictions provide, I believe, on the 1st of November, we'll be ready.
Are you concerned about resources in hospitals in the Upper Hunter with limited access to ventilators and reliance on larger hospitals such as the John Hunter for intensive care?
Well, look, we've been talking to Hunter New England, and Hunter New England have now had the time to prepare. They have had time to prepare for a pandemic-level response to this infection and the COVID crisis. And so they have a lot of facilities there ready to go, manage, and plans in place. And so we're ready. We're hoping that we won't see a mass outbreak. We won't see hospitalizations. And the evidence is saying that if you're vaccinated, you won't end up, or very, very minute chance of ending up in hospital. So that's the sort of level of protection we need. And then we're just looking at people who are unvaccinated, that small proportion that are left. There is a risk with those people that they do end up, but we've got the facilities there to cater for it. We can deal with a certain number of cases, and there's going to be a lot of focus on that. But we deal with it as a district, and you know, there may not be ventilators in some part, but we certainly have do better, and we know that we can. So, you know, that's the difference at the moment.
David Lazell, State MP for the Upper Hunter, ending that report by Talia Kreft. The Victorian arts industry was left feeling disappointed this weekend as they were given false hope of opening up when the Victorian government released an incorrect roadmap. They were told entertainment venues would be able to open up partially on Friday. However, they were later told this was a typo and the entertainment venues would not be able to open up until Victoria reached its 80% vaccination targets. Simone Schinkel, General Manager of the Theatre Network of Australia and Council Member of the Arts Industry Council of Victoria, spoke to The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg about the problems with the roadmap.
That's not viable. That's not a roadmap out of this situation. A roadmap out gets us back to 100%. We just need a full plan that gets us back to where we were, which is 100% with no restriction.
What is the importance of having a healthy and thriving arts and entertainment industry?
Well, I don't know what you've been doing in lockdown, but I think we've all been leaning on our television, our books, our music. All that is the arts and culture that lets us escape from the experiences that we're going through. It ignites the imagination. It does normally give us hope, but also helps us process things we have been through, and it gives that creative expression and identity. And then also it brings people together in times of celebration. So there's so much. I mean, after bushfires, the first thing we want is festivals to come back, because the way that they reunite people is just something really special that is not easily mimicked in other scenarios. And also there's a huge economic impact, like a $1.7 billion industry just here in Victoria, and that's just the live. So it's massive missed opportunity.
The arts and creative industry has been left in the lurch throughout the pandemic. How has this impacted Victorian artists both personally and within their professional lives?
There's a real trauma, collective trauma and disappointment that what you do is not valued. And yet this is things people commit their whole lives to. And I just hope that we can get some of those amazing people back.
The Victorian government has recently announced extra funding to support the creative industries through the process of opening up. Is this funding sufficient and accessible to those who need it?
It's never enough. You know, the scale of the impact is not yet met by the scale of support that's on offer. We understand that everyone's been impacted by the pandemic. We can't help but feel that we are disproportionately affected. And I think the other thing is that there's this lack of confidence. We've been calling for some insurance for a really long time because we've scheduled and rescheduled so many events that we've just run out of steam. Like, we can't keep rescheduling things with no end in sight. So if there was at least some insurance that could underwrite those risks. That would be really important and make a massive difference. The support from the state government, you know, they keep coming. So we're really delighted to see that, you know, those conversations are still happening and we haven't hit a brick wall or by any means. But these things also take time, and yet time is probably not what we have after 18 months of paying. People don't have the reserve or the savings that they once had. There's also a challenge between what role the federal government plays and what role the state government plays, because obviously the way the industry works is national and international. So border closures, inconsistent rules, like we're disproportionately affected by those types of arrangements.
How can the community best support artists and the broader creative industry in working towards finding ways to support and advocate for their cause?
So if they do want to go and see something, they probably need to really get politically involved and write to their local MP, whether that's a state-based MP or whether that's a federal MP, just to tell them how important arts and culture are to them and how much they've maybe relied on it during lockdown, but also how much they miss it. But I would just say really value your arts and culture, and this stuff can't come for free. There's lots of people doing lots of hard work behind the scenes, so it's great. The Victorian government have recently announced some outdoor activation support. And so we're like, yes, absolutely. Get us out there and doing, even if it's just a little bit, sooner rather than later. That just gives us the hope we need for the future.
Simone Schinkel, General Manager of the Theatre Network of Australia and Council Member of the Arts Industry Council of Victoria, speaking there with The Wire's Ayla Leibenberg. This week is National Anti-Poverty Week. As part of the push to recognise poverty in Australia, non-profit Food Bank have released their 2021 Hunger Report. It finds that many Australians are experiencing food insecurity for the first time due to the pandemic. The report also highlights that long-standing issues faced by regional areas and remote Indigenous communities in accessing food have deepened during the pandemic. I spoke with CEO of Food Bank New South Wales, John Robertson, about the findings of this year's report and how we can define food insecurity. What defines food insecurity?
Food insecurity is a very technical term, but it basically means not having or being in a position to put food on the table for three meals a day, 7 days a week. And we're seeing more and more Australians in that situation where they're living with food insecurity.
Well, the 2021 report found that more than 1.6 Australians can be categorised as severely food insecure. What kind of struggles to access food might someone be experiencing that would then classify them as severely food insecure?
Well, food insecurity is something that exists and has existed in Australia for some time. Someone who you would classify as severely would be going without food for a whole day on a regular basis, at least once a week. And there are more and more Australians that are finding themselves in that situation. What we've seen with COVID is people who've never found themselves in this situation are suddenly finding themselves living with food insecurity.
Yeah, these one in six Australians, as your organisation encourages people to think, are not just numbers, but they're people, they're Australians. Last year's report found that young people and casual workers made up a large proportion of this group. How have things changed in this year's report?
We're continuing to see more and more working Australians find themselves in the situation where they're living with food insecurity. But sadly, a lot of people who set the alarm every morning, go to work, are finding it more and more hard to make ends meet by the time you pay rent or a mortgage, cover your utility costs of electricity, water, if you need your vehicle to go to work. More and more people are finding themselves in a situation where, you know, at the end of the week, there's just not enough money to put food on the table. We're hearing of mums and dads who won't eat dinner with their kids. They'll make a story up like, you know, we had a big lunch at work today, that's why we're not eating, so the kids don't feel guilty. And I think for a lot of people, it's very hard to believe in a country like Australia that that could be happening.
As you said, the pandemic has really exacerbated a lot of these issues. We saw earlier this year in Walgett, during the COVID-19 lockdowns in New South Wales, there was a significant issues with supply, quality and fresh ingredients, or any food at all, really, to regional communities. How does food insecurity affect regional Indigenous communities?
It's a massive problem. Costs of food in those areas is huge. Access to good quality food is a problem. It's why Food Bank's been working with local charities in those areas like Walgett, Wilcannia, places like Boggabilla and the like. A lot of those remote Indigenous communities, we've worked with our charity partners, local councils and the Aboriginal land councils to provide emergency relief to these people. There is a longer term problem that needs to be addressed about providing ongoing quality food to people in those remote communities.
What are some of the things we need to see happen in order to reduce food insecurity in regional areas?
Look, I mean, things like insecure forms of employment are obviously contributing to that. If you've got a job in the gig economy or you're casually employed, it's hard to budget at the best of times. And sadly, more and more people are being forced into the situation where once you've cut your budget back as far as you can, more and more people are seeing food as a discretionary spending item.
John Robertson, CEO of Food Bank New South Wales, speaking with me there. That's it for The Wire today. You can find all our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can listen to our podcasts. Just search for The Wire wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for The Wire Radio, all one word. The Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or online weekdays. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. It was produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in then. I'm Sophie Ellis. Thanks for your company.
Come on.